So let's see. The discussion today, where I want to start today, is with just a little bit of a review. I suppose I could think of it, instead of being a review, I could think of it as being a kind of a comment on the very first sentence that in the reading for today. And the reading today is only these two paragraphs on page 51. So our reading keeps slowing down, slowing down and slowing down. I think that's okay. I think that,
Good, very good.
okay, good. I think that we're building up a kind of a shared body of knowledge, which is part of what's going on. We do have a new participant coming, Kathleen says, coming from a class with Ken. Okay, well, when she gets online, we'll see. Since she's late, I'm not going to be too concerned about it, but she can certainly check with me if she has any questions after the call. So the first sentence in the reading says, "Space and the freedom it offers are available at the center of present experience, just as it is." And that is, in fact, exactly the theme that we've been exploring in the last program, I think it's fair to say. The freedom that space offers and how that freedom is lost when we cover over space. And the question in part is in this quarter is going to be how we cover over space. So the fall quarter, the title of that program was Why Nothing Matters. And of course the reference was to the idea that space is nothing at all. And in fact, in one way you could say that's true, but another way you could say what we think of as nothing at all is freedom, is the source of freedom. There was that song that was popular in the 70s, I guess. That isn't doesn't quite have it doesn't quite say the right thing, but I think of it sometimes. It says, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." That's entirely the wrong tone, but that connection between freedom and nothingness is right. When we connect with the openness of experience, when we stop paying attention to substance, then we can rediscover space, and that space discovery makes freedom available. And that's really where we are and what we're looking at in this program, because our focus all year long is and has been and will be space. So the basic idea, I think, is clear, and the second part of that sentence makes the other fundamental point, which is it's right here. We don't have to go anywhere else. We don't have to go to some empty space in order to find the freedom that space offers, because space is available within all appearance, and that's what we've been looking at. Space, we find space when we let appearance appear without accepting the claims of appearance to substance. So that's really a kind of summary of where we've been, what we've been looking at. And the move that we're going to make now is to really look at that in terms of the structures that we impose on appearance. Because you could say, appearance is inseparable from space. Appearance is what space allows or accommodates, and then we close it down. And the way that we close it down is, and this is a little bit too simple, but in terms of the title of this chapter say, but the way that we close it down is through our thoughts, through thinking. And that is exactly what this first paragraph says. At the end of the paragraph, it says, to recover space presence, and that's what we've been talking about, we must clarify the operation of the thinking mind, whose active naming and identifying structure, whoops, sorry, whose active naming and identifying structure a world in which space has disappeared. So it's this activity of thinking in naming and identifying. And there's a kind of play on words in the title. Naming and identifying are key, but the title of the chapter is Thought Forms in Space. And you could take forms as a noun or you could take it as a verb. Thought forms substance in space by naming and identifying. And once you have substance, it's very interesting. It's a little bit like, and this is a novel I'm not even sure I ever read, but you know, there's that Kurt Vonnegut novel called Ice Nine, I think. And it's this substance that once one crystal of it is released, if I remember correctly, it will just immediately spread throughout the whole world and turn everything into ice. And that's actually a pretty nice image, if I remember the plot correctly. That's actually a pretty nice image because that's what thought does. Thought forms substance. And the moment you have even a little bit of substance, space disappears. You know, it immediately proliferates, and then we live in a world which is manufactured by substance. And that's the way that we encounter experience. So David has a comment on that, which is great. I encourage you to comment. Commenting on that first sentence, and he says, one of my great joys is discovering the space in a moment as I relax into it, like opening a clenched fist. Yeah, that's right. I you know, relaxation is not a word that is mentioned all that often in TSK. I'm sure that if you looked for it, and it's often interesting for those of you who have the CD version of the books, it's interesting to do a search for a word like relaxation and see how often it comes up and in what context. At least I find it interesting. But I don't think the word is used that often. But it is very closely connected to this idea of the freedom of space, right? The substance is tight. In Knowledge of Freedom, Rinpoche makes up a word talking about space, and it's like the word for time when we talk about intensifying experience, which has the tense of time in it, and also the tension of time, you could say. But he uses the word indensify or intensification. Space, when it's transformed into substance, or I should say perhaps appearance, when it's transformed into substance, becomes dense. And the way to open that up is to relax into appearance. Now we're going to be looking at exactly the way to open it up, but that's certainly a helpful thought. And anybody who likes to use Kumye, for instance, or some other kind of physical practice to really open up space and relax into space, that's a very good way to do it. I see that Sudi is having some problems, technical problems, which I assume Kathleen will take care of. And I see that we're about to get our new person, Marty Bush, but she doesn't seem to have quite joined us yet. Okay. So we're going to make this move where we focus on thinking and the way that thought forms substance in space. There's another word. When I was looking at the word forms, I thought about the word formulate, which is pretty interesting too. I don't know that I won't actually want to spend that much time on it, but you could say that when we engage, or let me put it this way, when we name and identify, which is the operation of the thinking mind, we're formulating a reality. We're saying this is the way it is. And you could say that, thought has this kind of formula that it uses to formulate experience, and then the result is that you get these things that are formed in space. That's the basic point we want to look at. The one thing that
Just
before
that
we
information.
in like an information, that's interesting, isn't it? I have to think about that a little bit. It's I okay I'll just that is interesting, but I'm not going to go with it right now. The other point that I want to make, and we've touched on this off and on at different times, the other point that I want to make is that the reason we can make this move from our focus right now, which has been more or less on the world around us, on appearance. Of course, it also involves our thoughts and so on, but the main focus has been on the world of physical space, let's say, and the notion that if we can contact appearance without substance, we encounter real freedom. So the focus has been on what appears to us, you could say. Now we're going toward the more active structuring dimension, which is the thinking, which names and identifies and formulates. But one of the really important things about the TSK vision as a whole is that it does not accept this distinction that we make between subject and object, between inner and outer. The role of thinking is not something that gets added on to experience or appearance, let's say. It's absolutely built into it. So, a lot of people talk about breaking down the barrier between subject and object. I mean, a lot of teachings of one kind or another talk about that. But I think it's really important to recognize how in TSK that distinction really it's not there from the very beginning. So, you might imagine this is because we're very, very committed usually to the distinction, to a kind of dualism between the world around us and our reaction to that world, or our ownership of that world, or our interpretation of that world. So all of those ways of engaging the world are based on the idea that first you have something like a world, or like an object that appears in front of you. And then you add on an interpretation or a claim or an understanding or a naming and or an identifying, which are terms that are used right here in this chapter, that it's kind of a two-step process. What we really need to understand that's very fundamental is that it's not a two-step process, it's a one-step process. Or maybe even to talk about steps is not so accurate, but we'll see. If it's a problem, we'll give it up. It's a one-step process because there isn't really any such thing as a world, especially a substantial world, which we then interpret and understand. The world is the world that we interpret, name, identify, formulate. I'm looking for a way to bring information in there, but I'm not sure. That's the reality. There's never been a separation. So, which is really important because it means we don't have to overcome any separation. The way that thought forms and names and identifies is absolutely fundamental. It's built in from the ground up. So there's a kind of a unity right there. And one of the things you could say, one of the things we're going to be doing is really trying to engage that unity, or see how it works in our experience. So that leads to the second paragraph in our reading, where Rinpoche starts to talk about thoughts, right? So the first paragraph says that the thinking mind is always naming and identifying, and it structures the world, and in that world, space has disappeared. That's the last sentence. And so now we need to understand something about the thinking mind, and that's what he starts to do in this paragraph. So in the first sentence, he says, although thoughts often come and go as a kind of reflex, passing so quickly that they go unnoticed, if we take the time to focus on the stream of mental events, we soon observe that we are almost always thinking. Now that's an unusual statement for TSK because usually Rinpoche does not make statements. He does not make claims. But in this case, he's very strongly making a claim. He's saying, if we look, we find that we're almost always thinking. And in my experience, a lot of people don't think that's true. And so I'd kind of like to throw it open for discussion. I'm actually not expecting I'll get a lot of comment right away, but we will practice with that for a minute or two. But just as, for starters, do people, the fact that Rinpoche says it here, please don't take that as meaning that it's got to be true or that just because you disagree, that must mean that you misunderstand. No, you're allowed to rely on your own experience. So let me ask at this point, do people, do any of you think that that's just really wrong, that, maybe it's true for other people, who knows, but it's not true for you, that you really don't spend your time thinking? So Alan says, oh, hell yes. Okay. anybody else or anybody who disagrees?
Yes. And I think if anyone disagrees, which I would have disagreed before, because I didn't understand what the definition of thought was. I'm completely past 3, 4, 5 months changed, understand very differently what thought is. And so, the reality it has been formed right in front of me as I look outside the window. I didn't know what that was a thought.
Right. So you were starting to fade out right at
Like
the
a
end.
dramatic
Okay.
emotional thing was a thought, not a thought now.
Okay. So we're having a little trouble on this call with some with transmission. So I missed a little of what you said, but I think I heard most of it. You were saying that you had a more narrow definition. That's not quite the right way to say it, but of what a thought is, that when you look out the window and you see a tree, the question is that a thought?
I
And
guess I lost connection.
yeah, we're having a little trouble on this phone call. I don't know why. People are losing connection, but it seems to be fading in and out. So I'll just have to keep talking here and hope. If I say everything twice, maybe once it will get through. It is being recorded, so when if people are having trouble and losing the connection, you can go back and listen, although I realize that's imposing an extra step on you, and I'm sorry about that. So we're at this idea of, well, what counts as a thought? I think that was Tsudeba's main question, and that her sense of that has really changed. And it partly has to do with what I said before, which is that if thoughts through their are what structure a world through naming and identifying, then we're always naming and identifying. And looking out a tree, looking out the window and seeing a tree is a perfect example of naming and identifying. That's definitely one aspect when you say, when you ask, well, is it really true that we're always thinking? That's important to notice. Let's see, we have a couple of other comments. Let's see, several actually, which is great. I appreciate that. So Kathleen makes a comment. She did it privately, but I don't think she meant to. I hope that's true, Kathleen, because I'm about to announce it to the world. She says, I work very hard trying not to have thoughts. I believe I have thoughts on top of thoughts, a sense there's something underlying even when I'm creating space to move thoughts out of my mind. Okay, well, good. One question is, if you're always thinking, what do you do about that? Whether trying not to have thoughts is, whether that's the right move is something I guess we will be investigating. The nature of thinking, is something we'll have to look at some more as we go along. So, Sudhi said that she had a narrower version of thoughts, in a narrower definition of thoughts. And my guess is, Kathleen, when you say that you try not to have thoughts, you're looking at that narrower version. So, thoughts, one aspect of thoughts is they take us out of our experience. We get lost in a thought world. And it seems to be valuable for a whole lot of reasons to be able to engage this world of, embodied reality, which is different from that thought world. So in that kind of narrower sense of thinking, it makes sense to say, let's do some practices that encourage us to stay in our experience. In the broader sense, where you say the very moment we name or identify something, that is a thought. There are certain practices, maybe in spiritual traditions, that will take you away from that, but that's not what we're looking at. We're just taking that as a given. That's the way it is. Now, there's a couple of other comments, and I will look at them, but and respond to them, and other people should feel free to respond to them too. Of course, it's not meant to be a one-on-one dialogue. It would be great if we were reacting to each other. But let me say one other thing about thoughts that might not otherwise come up, and I do want to make sure that we start to engage this part of it. When we identify something, we tend to say, or we tend to think that it's good to be kind of objective about our reality. That is, if we look at a tree outside the window and we say that it's a tree, we say, well, that's not a problem, and probably it's not a problem. There is another dimension of thought, though, which has to do with the reaction we have to seeing a tree or, speaking to someone where it's very obvious, or being here, engaged in this class right now. First, there's the identification, you could say, and then there's a reaction to it. So now we're back in a two-step process, and that's not exactly right because our reaction is really a part of the identification too. In other words, you don't just see a tree and then in the next moment react to it. Or maybe if you were looking very, very carefully, maybe that structure is right, but ordinarily, when you see the tree, maybe you like it, maybe you don't like it, maybe you wonder about what it was, maybe you remember sitting underneath the tree. there is a world that comes along with each thought. And part of that world, and this is the part I really want to emphasize, I think, is the kind of emotional tone that goes along with it, which really is part of the identifying and part of our thinking. So when I, let's take an internal example. When I remember something, I don't just remember the facts. I remember how I was reacting at the same time. And those two things go together. And again, you can't really make arbitrary distinctions. So I just happened to be reading a book yesterday by a philosopher talking about the self. And he gives an example, he's quoting someone else, but he says, suppose you try to imagine what it's like, what it was like, or what it's like to be Napoleon. Suppose you try to imagine that you are Napoleon. Well, Napoleon may not be the best example for everybody, so maybe we should take a more modern figure. Suppose we try to imagine what it's like to be Barack Obama, okay? And then the way he describes that is he says, well, you imagine, in effect, he says, you imagine what it's like to look out through his eyes. You imagine what it's like to be sitting in his office in the White House. You imagine what it's like to be meeting people or giving a speech, something, to be standing there in the auditorium. That's a very limited view. When you, and I think it's an interesting example. I may use it somewhere, but I don't think I'll use it in here, in our class today. But when you imagine what it's like to be somebody else, you imagine not just what they see through their eyes, but what they feel, right? And really, what I'm suggesting here is that that too is a part of the naming and identifying. We see a world. And that world is not just an objective world that we then react to. It's already a world that has feelings and emotions and responses and responsibility and all of that built into it. So there's at least those three different levels of thoughts. There's the thoughts that where we get lost in our in a thought world and we're not there, where what Michael says is, talks about his zoning out. We're about to look at his comment. That's one kind of thought. Then there's the thought that names and identifies, and in theory we could say it's just kind of a naming thought. It's like looking a word up in the dictionary. You see something, you need to know what it is, so there's a thought that labels it. And then there's this third kind of thought, and I'm really saying the second and the third are not really separate from each other. Which reacts and brings us into the level of emotionality and so on. So let's take a look at a few more comments here. Michael says, okay, zoning out, I don't notice that I'm thinking. But whenever I look, that itself is a thinking operation. Well, that's true. It is one of the puzzling things or the kind of challenging or maybe frustrating things about looking in mind. It doesn't have to be frustrating unless you think it ought to be different. And that is that whenever you look, whenever you try to investigate mind or some mental operation, that's another mental operation. And so, it's like trying to do two things at once. The classic example of that that's given nowadays in philosophy is when you try to open the refrigerator door to see if the light is still on when the door is closed. The very act of opening the door makes it impossible to answer the question. And that's kind of how it is with mental events, but we don't have to worry about that so much, for reasons I guess I won't try to go into now, because we're getting, we have a lot of, even though we're only reading two paragraphs, there's a lot of things to say. Brigitte says, only when you really try to watch your thoughts, you realize how constantly streaming they are, simultaneously even, unfinished ones or more shaped. And Kathleen approves of that. I think that's what the LOL stands for, the laugh out loud. Now, oh, she adds to that, creating a more openness, not to limit the thoughts. Okay, that goes back to your earlier comment, Kathleen. Marty's commenting. Marty is the new person that Kathleen mentioned to be joining us. Welcome, Marty. I'm glad you're with us. Brigitte, I think that's exactly right. When you try to watch your thoughts, you realize how pervasive they are. Now, we need to acknowledge something that Rinpoche says in this in these two paragraphs we're looking at, which is that in fact, it's not easy to notice thoughts. In the first sentence of the second paragraph, he says they pass so quickly. They're a reflex, right? They're a kind of reflex, he says. They pass so quickly that they go unnoticed, right? And then at the end of that paragraph, in the last sentence, he says, as we go about our day, thoughts cycle through our minds like the background hum of a household appliance, or a nervous gesture that we repeat almost unconsciously. So there's this kind of, maybe that's a fourth kind of thought. I talked about three kinds before. And again, it's really important, I think, to be, to become aware of it. And that is the kind of thought that's almost unconscious. And a good place to look at that, it seems to me, is the judgments that we make. We see somebody like walking down the street, at least for me, walking down the street is a great place to notice that because of the people you see. Maybe other people look more in store windows or whatever, but I look at people. It's almost impossible, it seems to me, to see a person without having a judgment come up along with the seeing. And I don't necessarily mean a judgment about, that's a good person, that's a bad person. So maybe the term isn't quite right. But what I mean is the way you react to the person. And there is a certain tendency. Maybe you say, oh, I might like that person if I got to know them, or I might not. Or I find that person attractive, or I find that person weird, or I find that person, whatever. That's the kind of unconscious stuff, the background hum of the appliance. It's kind of a psychic cost, you could say. And that's why hum of, the hum of an appliance is a good example. A refrigerator is the perfect example, it seems to me, because the hum is the motor working, and that's just kind of the cost you pay. That's a reminder that electricity is operating and you're going to have to pay the electric bill. And you'd say, well, that has nothing to do with the real purpose of the refrigerator, which is to keep things cold. Or, I mean, yes, it does have something to do with it, but that's not what I care about with the refrigerator. I care about whether it's keeping things cold. But in fact, there is this background stuff, this chatter that goes on. So everybody seems pretty convinced that this statement is true, that there are thoughts going on. Let me keep going down the oh, this is what has really brought up a lot of response. That's great. Okay. So let's see. So Marty asks a question, and this is good because Marty's coming from a class that was taught by somebody else, and so then different kinds of questions get asked, which is great. And not to say, Marty, that you're just repeating what you came up in a class. We all have our own questions, and we all get to ask original questions and inquire into them in our own way. But anyway, the question is, if you look at a thought and it disappears before the next thought, is there really thought? Okay, this is a question that comes up in TSK in part because Rinpoche introduces an exercise in the first TSK book, and I think it comes up in another book too, which is space between thoughts. Is it possible to have a space between thoughts where there isn't any thinking going on. That's the question Marty's asking, right? Before the next thought, is there really thought? That's a great question. And in fact, I'm going to encourage, I'm going to invite people, make a note to myself, to look at that during the week. There's at least two possible answers, and there are probably more. But the two obvious ones are yes and no. Yes, and applying that, what I mean is, yes, there's a space between thoughts where there's no thinking, and no, there's never a space between thoughts because at least the moment you identify it. Now, maybe there's a space that you don't identify, but the moment you say, oh, here's a space between thoughts where there's no thinking, well, clearly that's a naming and identifying, right? So then the question becomes, well, but do we always have to be naming and identifying? And that yes and no, and we're kind of running out of time here, but that yes and no is leads to two different approaches, you could say, to how you want to engage the relationship between space and thoughts. One is to say that being involved in thinking is just another word for setting up appearance. We things appear as we name and identify them. And if we understand that's the product, that the formulation of the thinking, then the appearance doesn't have to close off space. And so that would be saying, well, even if I always find thoughts, and Rinpoche says here we're almost always thinking, he leaves the possibility open that it could be otherwise. So that's one possibility. You'd say within thoughts or within the world that thoughts structure, maybe not those kind of spacing out, zoning out thoughts that take us into their own world, but the thoughts that name and identify, within those we can still find space by allowing appearance simply to be appearance, or by allowing thought structures just to be thought structures, thought forms. That's one possibility. The other possibility is to say there is a possibility for going into a space between thoughts, and then we really are in contact with space. And then the question becomes, can we engage the knowing that that allows for without turning it into a thought? So that's a really interesting question and would be a nice place to stop, but I want to go ahead and look at some other comments that people made, and then we'll stop. So David brings this into the realm of listening to music. He says, when I separate pure listening to music, that's not thought. But when I compare the melody or rhythm to the silence or notice sequencing, then I'm thinking. Okay, this is good because it's exploring this difference. When I taste something, the pure input of the sense of taste soon becomes a comparison of thoughts about the taste. There's a difference between the input from the sense field and the thoughts about the sensing, methinks. Yes. So right, that's the question to ask. Is there such a thing as a pure sense field? It's very much like saying, is there a space between thoughts? It's not the same thing, but it's pointing in the same direction. And it's a great question to be looking at. And yeah, so Marty agrees that before the naming and identifying, and Sudhi says, the reason I'm reading these things out is because people call in. We have at least one person here who's calling in, or at least they don't seem to be here anymore. But when they call in, they can't see the chat room, so that's why I repeat this. So Sudhi asks, is appearance a thought? Well, so there's two answers to that. One is yes, it's a thought. The other one, and the one that's probably more important, is the claim that appearance is something more than a thought is a thought. That's the one we'd like to focus on. And David asked that too. Yes, if it's a thought, that is. So he's coming back to the point. There is a distinction to be made here. There's such a thing as a direct sense experience. right? Not thinking. So let me raise one challenge to that way of looking. I'm not saying that that way of looking is wrong, but I just want you to investigate it. If we're talking about direct sense experience, so if I taste something and I have the immediate burst of flavor, let's say, and I haven't yet even identified it, nonetheless, isn't there a structure in which I am tasting something? And isn't that a naming and identifying? So I'm going to let you think about that because we're out of
We
time.
can't get away.
I don't know. I mean, actually, I have to say that my tendency, and this is me personally, is roughly what you just said, that we need to find our freedom within appearance, within thoughts, because you really can't get away, or it's very difficult to. And there are other people who say, no, it really is possible to drop that whole commitment. So you're getting, my take is one particular take. There is another approach, and I think it'd be great to continue to be exploring that. So this is definitely one question, and I will in the orientation for next week, I'll make sure to bring this up, this question about direct sensing, and what is there a possibility for experience without thinking? Even given what Rinpoche says, which is that we're always, almost always thinking. Okay, let's stop there for today. I will post the orientation soon with some of these very interesting issues that came up. And I'll also suggest a couple of exercises you could do during the week. Good. Thanks, everybody.